Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we are discussing Stephen King's 1996 novel, Desperation. It is one of his twin novels, the other being The Regulators, which was under his Richard Bachman name. So we're going to be talking about one half of sort of this bigger picture today. And Katie, I know you haven't read The Regulators just yet, but with Desperation, did you kind of get a sense that there was something bigger going on than what you just read in the book?
Yes, yes, definitely. It felt like King is expansive, to say the least. And in this book, it felt like there definitely was something else going on. And you didn't really find out what was going on in this book until pretty far in.
Yeah.
So I feel like I need to read The Regulators now so that I know what the other side of this is.
Right. Yeah, it's one of those things where the books literally came out on the same day, but because he put them out under different names. I mean, by this point, everyone pretty much knew he was Richard Bachman, I think, as far as people who had been following along with his work the entire time. So it's probably not a surprise for too many people who were constant readers, as he would call them. But I think it was an interesting tactic because it's not very often that you get an author releasing two books on the same day, especially like this. So with Desperation in particular, you kind of read what it's about and then you're like, oh, the city's in Nevada. Oh, okay. That makes sense. This feels like a desperate area for sure, because it's all desert and dry heat and sort of just this disgusting weather for a good chunk of the year. So it was kind of a perfect setting, but it's also one that we don't typically see from King. He really likes his main settings, or even Colorado, sort of these woodsier places. And to have this be in the desert, it was just such a stark contrast from a lot of his other stories. And it had so many characters like it to where you were like, okay, wait, who's related to who? What's going on here?
Right? Yeah, this was very different at times from what I've read from him before. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still feels very much like a Stephen King book, of course, but how stark and spare the desert is really sets a different tone for this story. Like, not that all of his other books are super hopeful, you know, that's not an accurate thing, but this one feels really dark. Like, it took me a little bit to get into it because there's nothing good. Like, there's no hope, especially in the beginning. Things get nasty quick, and you can tell that it's only going to continue to get worse. And the desert very much personifies that, especially with how many animals he uses in this one. Uh-huh. And it's all like scorpions and spiders and buzzards and that kind of thing, which are not, you know, you don't typically think of those animals as very cuddly. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a few, but not me. So I think he uses that setting really well. And it was a interesting change that, even though it was kind of hard to get into at first, I really liked how he used it.
I agree. This one took a little time to grow on me, for sure. And it was one of those things I was like, oh no, is this going to be one of the ones I don't like? And thankfully, I did end up liking it in the end. And I think a lot of that had to do with the work he did with David Carver in particular, because he's this young boy who doesn't necessarily have any glaring powers at first. It's not like he's like Charlie from Firestarter, who is lighting people and things on fire, either on purpose or accident, all the time. So you have this slow buildup with the boy and what he's able to do. And it was just so well paced, even though the rest of the story really took a while to get into. And you have just, like I said, so many characters, you kind of wonder, okay, we can't keep them all around. It's kind of, again, like it. You know that with the number of characters you have between the good guys and the bad guys and Pennywise and it, something is going to happen. Not all of them are going to make it out. And with this, you have Tack, who is the evil villain in this, but needs to have a host body. And Tack takes on Kali Intragians. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, but the cop's body. So you just have this cop who is an authority figure going around telling people what to do, and they're inclined to listen because he's a cop, and his cover story is basically that there's a lone shooter out there just shooting people at random, and that gives these people a reason to not want to be standing out in the middle of the desert. But then he's doing things like planting evidence on people, and, you know, he's frustrating them at the same time. And as the story continues, you see him kind of taking a family, taking one person, taking a couple people, and it just adds up over time. And you're like, okay, we gotta be able to keep these characters straight here.
Right. And it throws them at you really quickly. And, you know, it kind of goes from scene to scene of him taking each different group. And then we get to the point where the group is together. And there's, I think, at least one more person we meet in there at that point. And the characters, I thought he did a good job kind of delineating each one so that they all feel kind of different and they all add something to the story. But yeah, it needed some slimming down, and that does eventually come. Like, eventually there's not so many to keep straight. But, and I liked the fact that he included Cynthia from Rose Matter, which we've talked about in this, and she plays a pretty decent role, I would say. And I really enjoyed how he uses David. I think I was kind of skeptical at first. I was like, endowed by God boy, okay. Let's see how he does with this. But I think he uses kind of just the right amount of it and doesn't get real overblown with the religiosity of that character. You know, that character very much acknowledges the cruelty of an infinite God and all of that. So it never feels preachy, and David never really feels preachy. He just feels very passionate about his beliefs.
Oh, absolutely. And in typical Stephen King fashion, he includes a writer in the group. So you have Johnny Maranville, who is this best-selling author, and the cop kind of recognizes him. And there's this sense that this is a guy who all of these other people are probably going to recognize, even if it takes them a minute. Because a lot of times, yes, there are author pictures on the inside cover or on the back of books, but not everyone necessarily like studies an author's picture every time they read a book. So it's likely it'll take a minute for these characters to recognize who he is. And I like how realistic that felt, because you were like, yeah, okay, maybe it would take me a minute to recognize some of these authors whose books I've read, because I don't sit there and stare at the back cover forever. And, you know, of course, this writer has to have an ego, and he has Steve Ames, who is helping him out. I'm not really sure what Steve is doing. He's driving a rental truck, from what I can tell, and moving some stuff for him, and he's out on his motorcycle, but they aren't together for whatever reason, probably because Johnny doesn't want to be held back by a rental truck while he's on his motorcycle. And that's when you sort of start figuring out, okay, how do these people all know each other? How is this going to play out? Who's going to stick by whose side this entire time? Obviously, the Carver family is going to want to stick together, but Kali doesn't let that happen. You have Mary and Peter Jackson, who are a couple, and they both don't survive together. So you have these couples and families being torn apart throughout this entire thing, too. And it just adds so much trauma to these characters after we meet them.
Right. And we don't, other than Johnny, I would say we don't get much of a sense for who these people were before.
True.
We know Cynthia because she's in a previous book, and we get quite a bit of who Johnny is. But, you know, Steve and Mary and the other folks in there and the Carver family is just not as developed.
David is probably the most fleshed out of the Carver family, because we get the whole backstory with his friend who was in the hospital.
Yes.
And he went and said this prayer and agreed to these terms, and the friend woke up almost immediately after. So you do get a sense of, okay, this thing with David started before this interaction with Tack. But you have this background for him and for Johnny because it's kind of King's way of letting you know, hey, you really need to pay attention to these two characters in particular.
Yes, I agree. I think, and how he tells us about each of them in these kind of alternating flashbacks about their lives, like as we need to know that information, he kind of drops it in there and allows them to grow and become more fully realized characters. And it becomes more satisfying to read about them because I think they kind of share the protagonist role in this book. You know, each one kind of, I think the book is mostly from the two or their perspective, from what I'm remembering. Like, I think Steve gets a little bit of time in the driver's seat, if you will, but mm-hmm. I think in general, it's kind of David and Johnny's show.
Yeah.
And they are so different. Their lives, their identities, how they approach everything is completely different. And it feels throughout the book, like there's a lot of conflict between the two of them, but it's usually fairly subtle, I think.
Yeah.
And then by the end, you know, they have to save each other essentially, you know, as one will do it and then the other one does it. And it becomes this really deep relationship between two people who you didn't necessarily expect to have that deep relationship in the beginning of the book.
Yeah, I want to talk a little more about Tack specifically because it's not a person. What it does is it takes over people's bodies, and then when it's sort of worn them out, it can jump to another body. So later in the story, once Collie is really beat up and sort of starting to look defeated, it jumps into David's mother's body. So then you have someone who looks like his mother going around, but with all of these evil intentions. And obviously David is gifted enough to understand what is going on. But it's one of those things where you can tell there's still this tension because this thing looks like his mom, Ralph's wife, and, you know, the sister and daughter is dead. So you have this very, very sad story for the Carver family in particular because David is the only one who survives.
Right. And for, you know, it starts so senselessly with the little girl when she just gets thrown down some stairs.
Yeah.
And we don't even see it happen. Like, that's just, it's talked about, but we don't get that scene. She's dead when we meet her. And then his mom being taken. I mean, there was a considerable period of time in that book where you don't know what's going on with that, where Entragian, as occupied by Tack, is kind of out of the story as we're getting these people moved on to the next location and moving everything forward. But throughout the whole time, I'm like, what happened to Ellen? Something terrible is happening to Ellen. Oh, God. Oh, God. And it just drove so much tension. And then you don't even find out how Tack is taking these people. You know, we know that he does, but that scene where you actually see how it happens takes place last 150 pages of the book. And it's so horrifying. Like, uh-huh. How that scene goes down is, you really see the conniving cruelty that Tack has. And you know, it really becomes apparent that this thing is going to do anything it can to destroy everything it can.
And you never really know what its motivations are either. It's like, is it trying to accomplish something and doesn't want anyone getting in the way? Does it just need to feed? And King never really truly answers that question. So you're just left with your imagination running wild. And like you said, it's like when David's mom is taken and you're kind of like, I can only imagine what is happening to her right now. And we never truly know what that is. So you have these open-ended sections of the story where you're like, okay, my imagination is going to run wild. I have no idea if this is accurate or not. But sometimes that's part of the beauty of some of his stories is that you can decide what you think is going on. And you'll never really get an answer, but you also don't really need one because if you've been reading King books all along up until this point, you kind of know what his mindset is like when he's writing a book and how much trauma characters are going to go through in general.
Right, right. And it makes it so when he does those things, when he has these little moments where something bad is happening out of sight, it makes it all the worse because you never know if you're going to get that part of the story or if he's just going to leave it up to your imagination, because he is very good at picking what he should leave up to the imagination. It's never something that will drive the story forward. It's something that will make the story more upsetting or scary or whatever he's going for. And he does that particularly well in this book. Because, I mean, this book takes place over 2 days, I think is what we determined. And
yeah, it's about a day or two because it's like they're all driving during the day and you figure he's taken the Carver family already when we first meet him. So you have this guesstimate as to when he first took someone, and you have Steve and Cynthia coming along later, and you're kind of like, okay, all right. Seems like they were taken somewhat recently. Obviously, you know, they got there about an hour after Johnny was taken, and then you have the nighttime scenes, and then the next day is kind of when everything starts to wrap up. So you figure somewhere between 24 and 48 hours, give or take, and it's not a long time by any means, given how long this book is too. So one thing I wanted to ask you about was the story overall. Did it feel like there were any lulls that really made you just want to hurry up and get it over with? Or do you think that by the time you got through learning about all these characters, as much as King was going to give us anyway, that the story kind of paid off?
I think the story, it's a little bit of both for me, honestly. I think the story does pay off in the end. Okay. And I think the information he imparts in those bits where I was like, okay, why? And most of that was when you're learning about Johnny. It's like, this guy's an asshole. And I did constantly wonder, I was like, is he parodying himself or is this a writer that he knows? Because you gotta think he knows a lot of writers.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was those moments of wondering, like, okay, how is this going to come into the story? That's what I'm always asking when I have those moments of feeling like almost bored, is what am I going to get out of this? Because he is not, well, I think he can be a bit rambly. In general, if he's giving you information, it's information you're going to need to put the end together. And the ending of this is pretty satisfying, I thought. Mm-hmm. And I think he paid it off. He paid off those moments for me. How did you feel about it?
Like you, it took me a while to get into it. But then once I was into it, I was like, okay, this is really tense. Things are, you know, getting very suspenseful. And even though there's this supernatural element to it, you can tell that what these people are feeling is real. It's panic setting in. It's them trying to figure out how they're going to survive because they're basically in the middle of nowhere. It's not like Vegas is down the street or anything. So
right?
They're kind of in this place that it's one of those towns where if you blink, you'll miss it kind of thing. And it's basically still just a mining town at this point. You obviously have a main street and, you know, a few other things, and that's about it. So by no means is this a place that people are going to be constantly driving by or driving through, because it's kind of off the main highway. You kind of have to wind your way around to get to it. And the story kind of does the same thing. It kind of winds its way around until it really gets to the point, I would say, in like the last third of the book. And it gives you some moments where you have to remember to breathe, because you're getting so wrapped up in the tension and everything that these characters are feeling. You're like, okay, hold on. I'm just reading a book. Need to take a few breaths here and then we can carry on. And sometimes you're like, that's probably what the characters need to do too, if we're being honest, especially once they're all in the theater that has been closed down. And just even though they're all in one place, there's still so many things going on. They're like, okay, we have to put these bottles by the window in the bathroom so that if anyone comes in, we'll hear it. And we need to make sure everything's locked up. And then things still go crazy in there because then they're not agreeing and other things happen. And it's one of those stories where you really get into it, I would say more so about halfway through it. And we've talked about various King books where sometimes you just can't get into it. And that would have been for both of us, the Tommyknockers, which interestingly enough, there's a mention of the Tommyknockers in this book. So I was a little worried. I was like, oh no.
Yep.
you mentioned the one thing.
Yep. That's not a good sign. Yeah, exactly. I think it's such a slow burn almost, even though so much happens from the first minute of the book, first page, like stuff is happening all the time, but it's kind of drawn out, you know, because it takes place over such a short period of time. We are seeing like a minute by minute playthrough almost of these people's lives. And so by the time they get to the theater, that I think is really the turning point as well for me. Like that is when we know who these people are and we can see the danger they're in. And now they have a second to figure out what they're going to do. And so now all of their personalities are going to clash and everybody's going to have their own opinions. And I think in particular, the use of Audrey, the other hand of Tack that kind of takes place in this, is such a great reveal. That moment when you realize like, oh, this lady is not what we were led to believe, is really ramps everything up so well. And that was, I think, really the point when I was like, all right, now I am into this and I am here for it. So because I was like, okay, so no one can be trusted. It's not just that he can take or Tack takes over animals.
Yeah.
And one host, like he can get into anybody given the right circumstances.
You also have that moment when I think the story takes a turn before the movie theater where things are kind of like, okay, we know what David can do. And then he, you know, undresses and slips through the bars to get out and to go get the keys. And I think that moment in particular is part of the story where you're like, okay, these people are going to get out. We know not all of them are going to make it out of here because you get this image that the cop has grown in size since Tack took over his body. And this guy was already big to begin with, from what we can tell. So the fact that he grew even just a few more inches just makes him that more intimidating, especially when the person you're relying on is as small as David is.
Right? He looms over everything in the book. And it's interesting that he is only in the very beginning, but his shadow falls long over the book, even once he's gone and Ellen is Tack. It's such a clever use of setting a stage for a character. And you continue hear about him. Like, they continue to call Tack Entragian for a long time throughout the book, even after they know that he's no longer Entragian. It's such a scary thing to think about a huge man becoming larger and evil, because it feels like he's unstoppable, especially for David.
Were there any other moments in the story that really stood out to you as moments that you think will kind of stick with you after finishing up this book?
I think the scene with David where he goes into the trance and he's in the land of the dead, and we really get a lot of detail about, as much detail as we're going to get about what Tack is. I think that scene is so well done. I love his like hallucinatory trance scenes. I always enjoy them because they always go weird ass places. And I figured that was Johnny, like from the beginning, the guy in the aviator glasses that David is talking to in that, who reveals all of this info for him. But I think the philosophical parts that he puts in there in that scene, and because the two of them kind of get into this deeper discussion of what God is and why David should continue doing what God wants and all of that. And I think that part is well done. And it's a difficult line to walk, especially in a horror novel like this. That's a weird diversion to take, but it is still so interesting. And I think it works well with what King is trying to do here. Because without that, I think it would feel much lighter. Like it would still be dark and nasty, but the content and the message, I think, of this would be much lighter and not have so much substance, that I felt makes it a more powerful book in those final moments.
You mentioned earlier that you found that the ending was satisfying in this one, and endings are something we've talked about a ton throughout this podcast. And I think not knowing what happens to David after he gets in the car with Mary and they leave is the right move, because of the fact that he already lost everything. What else do you need to know? That's not something he's just going to get over a week from now, a year from now, or whatever it is. You know, he lost his sister and his parents all within this short time span. And sure, he has this trust in Mary, Steve, and Cynthia at the end of it, but it's never going to be the same for him. And that's really all that you as the reader need to know.
Right. I think as I was approaching the ending, I was like, okay, really? We still, like, we're not in, like, the afterword portion, which is what I'm used to from King books. I was like, oh, God, shit is still happening. This is crazy. Like, we're not going to get much resolution. And then we absolutely do not get much resolution for these people's lives like we do in, say, Christine, where we see, what, like, 15, 20 years later for these characters and how it's affected them. Like, we get them driving out of the desert, and that's it. And it is all the more gut-wrenching for that choice, because it leaves you feeling a little hopeless, because obviously we're seeing David so strongly affected by the trauma that he's experienced. And I think we get the sense that he's going to be okay, but he's never going to be the same. And he's always going to have to live with this horrific series of events, supernatural series of events, no less. And it's kind of a punch to the gut. And I really applaud him for doing that, because I think he does have a tendency to, like, well, I want to make everybody feel a little bit better after the end of the book, so I'll show these people's lives continuing on. And with this story and how brutal it is, I think that that's the right choice, is to end it quick and just kind of leave us feeling a bit bereft for David.
It's almost like in a movie when you get that ending of people driving off into the sunset or something, but you know it's not a happy ending by any means.
Right, right. It is not a happy ending. I mean, David loses his dad. You know, his dad would have died, what, like 15 minutes before this, 20 minutes before they've gotten away?
Yeah.
Tops an hour. And then he finds the note from Johnny, and, like, it just is. He continues to go through trauma even after, like, you know, the big bad has been defeated and they're supposed to be, you know, moving on at this point. And he's still experiencing these hard moments up until, you know, the last 5-10 paragraphs of the book. So it's a real hard read all the way through, I think.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's what makes the ending at least satisfying as a reader in the end, because you're like, okay, we didn't want a happy ending necessarily either. So we kind of get this open-ended thing where you know that David, Mary, Cynthia, and Steve are all going to have their lives go on, but they are going to be forever changed by the events of the last 36-ish hours.
Yep, very much so. And it's so sad. But it also, despite its intensely supernatural elements, it also feels very realistic in that way. And that, you know, when we experience trauma as individuals, it's not something that we just get to put down and everything's okay at the end. We all have to learn to handle the experiences and find a way through them. And I think this book is a great example of how to show that. This ending of this book is a great example of how to show that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I know we have been keeping these episodes a little tighter here, but is there anything else about the book in particular that you want to discuss?
I don't think so. I think I am interested in reading The Regulators, because I wonder how that will affect my view of it. So I know you finished The Regulators. Do you think that, you asked me in the beginning if I thought that I felt like there was something missing. Having read The Regulators, do you feel like reading both of them gives you a wider perspective on the story?
I think it gives you a wider perspective on what tack is. And I think that's something that you don't really get a whole lot of in this one. You're kind of like, oh, we don't really know how he takes over people's bodies and how he is controlling things, or how it is controlling things. So you definitely get more of that entity in The Regulators. And I think it's approached from a different standpoint a little bit because of who Tack, I guess, embodies in the Regulators, but it's definitely an interesting thing to read both of these immediately back to back. And I literally finished the Regulators this morning before we recorded this. So it was one where I was like, all right, I'm just going to crank these out, get them done as fast as possible, because I feel like while sometimes I can get a little fuzzy on the details reading Stephen King books that quickly, I felt like because they both came out on the same day and they're these twin novels, it would make more sense to do it that way instead of taking a break in between and risk sort of forgetting more of what I read in desperation.
Right. That's kind of what I'm thinking is like, I wasn't sure if I was going to read it. I was like, yeah, let's see how desperation is and then we'll decide then. But now I'm like, okay, well, I would like to know more about Tack. So I probably will go on and get this one too.
So what would you say your rating for this ended up being?
I would say probably a 3.5 out of 5.
Okay.
Like maybe even a 4, like between 3.5 and 4 almost, because it's so brutal and hard to read at some points.
Yeah. I gave it a 4 out of 5 on Goodreads, if I'm not mistaken, and that is probably more so for the lack of not being able to use half stars on Goodreads still, which will forever be a complaint of mine until they fix it, but it is what it is, and I sometimes will like put in the full star rating and then like in the little review section put like 3.5, you know, just for personal reference. And it was one of those things where I was kind of torn because I know that while I was reading it, some things went over my head. Like it didn't even really click for me that Cynthia was the same character from Rose Matter until you said it while we were discussing it. And I was like, oh yeah, duh.
Yeah, after I read Rose Matter, I went and I looked at the Wikipedia page, and that's when I saw, oh, Cynthia appears in Desperation. So when, you know, we talked about doing this one, I was like, oh, all right, well, I'll know one of the characters at least. And I think we don't get a whole lot of her from Rose Matter, yeah. But I think she does feel a bit different in this novel. And I liked that we got to know more about her and the sisters and daughters, or daughters and sisters,
whatever it group. Was called.
Right, and how they fared after all of those crazy events go down.
Yeah. Well, I feel like a bad host for not catching it, so thank you for catching that for me, since I am clearly needing a break. So, you know, after this episode, we have several movies and TV series, TV movies coming up, and you know, I'll get a slight break, a few days here at least, to get ready for The Dark Tower, Wizard in Glass, which is the 4th book. But Katie, I know you will be back on soon, so thank you for coming on to talk about Desperation today.
Yes, thank you. It was a good one. I liked reading it, and I liked having a discussion about it, because it's weird. It's a little different than King's usual stuff.
It definitely is, and I hope you enjoy The Regulators. You won't be back on for that one, but I'm sure you and I will be texting while you're getting through it.
Yes, definitely.
And quickly, before we go, I want to let you all know about our Patreon. You can support this podcast for $1 a month. That'll get you a thank you on the show. $2 a month will get you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And you can also follow us on social media at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.